Universal Civil Code is what we are talking about today. You know what? India is always in election mode. But at this point, going up to next 12 months and the following six, so say in the next 17 or 18 months, India is going to be seeing back-to-back elections. So you have Gujarat right now, then you have Karnataka. I'm only counting the major states. There'll be a lot of smaller states also going to the polls. Then Madhya Pradesh, Rajasthan, Chhattisgarh, and then the big one, national election of 2024 summer. So the BJP obviously has to think of an agenda, has to think of an idea, and it has to be a polarizing idea. It has to be a polarizing idea which gives the electorate a choice. Do you want this or this? And which also forces their opponents to make a choice on a polarizing issue. So universal civil code. Should there be one set of personal laws? What are personal laws? The important things are marriage, divorce, inheritance, adoption, things like that. Should there be one kind of laws for all? Or does each faith or do people of each faith then continue to be governed by their own laws? So that is the new binary that the BJP is now setting up. So several BJP states have already talked about it. They've already ratcheted it up. Usually they've done it in the run-up to their own elections. So states which have now set up their own committees to debate their own universal civil codes are Uttarakhand, BJP. They did that on the eve of the last election, the recent election. Gujarat, they've done it in the run-up to this election. Himachal Pradesh, again in the run-up of this election. Madhya Pradesh, and that's the reason we talk about this today. Shivraj Singh Chauhan, who otherwise is seen to be more of a pacifist leader, he's now all fire and brimstone. This is his new avatar. He's talked about and he's talked very strongly about why there should be a universal civil code. In fact, you can see that tiny tape that will run, tiny video that will run on my screen as I talk. And you can see his mood. And he says, Ek desh mein do vidhan kyon chale? Why should there be two laws in one country? Ek se zyada shadi koi kyon kare? And then he goes on to say, Okay, dekhiye, in tribal areas, non-tribals can't buy land. So he's trying to take it beyond the Hindu-Muslim binary that Muslims can marry more than one woman. So he's trying to take it beyond that. He's saying in tribal areas, people from outside, non-tribals cannot buy property. So what do they do? Even if they are married, they have a wife back home, they take a tribal as a wife. And then in her name, they buy properties and run businesses. Why should that go on? And then he says, Main jagran ki alag jagane aaya hoon, which means I have come to light the fire of an awakening. Now, these are very aggressive statements from Madhya Pradesh Chief Minister, who usually is not given to sounding like that. So this is something that the BJP has now adopted as a strategy. Now, what does the UCC mean? So I will share with you a story that my colleagues Neelam Pandey from our political bureau in Delhi and Prithvi Singh, who's our correspondent in Dehradun, Uttarakhand, they had done based on the findings of the Uttarakhand committee. Now, Uttarakhand committee on UCC was a high-powered one. It was headed by Ranjana Prakash Desai, Justice Ranjana Prakash Desai, who's a retired judge of the Supreme Court of India, no less. So they have not formally released anything, but a lot that has come out, the committee got more than 4 lakh suggestions, held a lot of hearings. So, of the highlights that this story notes, there is one, complete inheritance rights to Muslim women, right? A lot of it's like, we are doing this for equality or justice to Muslim women. So, complete inheritance rights to Muslim women, registration of all talaqs or divorces done according to Muslim tradition, and also registration of live-in relationships. Now, once again, that is taking the idea of universal civil code beyond the Hindu-Muslim binary. It's a pretense because, you know, do you really need to register live-in relationships? Because what that does is it takes people's freedom away. Then why don't they just get married? The informality or the freedom of a live-in relationship or the flexibility of a live-in relationship goes away. And these are my views. And also, if you register a live-in relationship and then you have a breakup, does that mean that somebody is entitled to some maintenance, compensation? Then you are moving into hybridizing a marriage kind of situation or like a or like an agreement or a legal agreement before you have a live-in relationship. So once again, how sustainable that will be, I don't know. But I am also talking about this a bit more because this is also not in the Hindu-Muslim context. Then ban on polygamy and polyandry. Now, polyandry, I don't particularly think it's a problem in India. In fact, the only place where it's supposed to exist, I don't know how much of it is still existing, but traditionally, it's been existing with some tribes in upper Himachal Pradesh, I think in the Kinnaur region or someplace, where polyandry has seemed to be a tradition, a tribal tradition. In fact, there is also folklore that that is the route the Pandavas took on their way to heaven after Mahabharata, and that's how this tradition of polyandry, remember, Draupadi had five husbands, so that was polyandry. That is the most famous case of polyandry in our tradition and our scriptures. So, I lived in Chandigarh. We had a lot of students from Himachal Pradesh. There was a lot of talk about Himachal and polyandry. And generally, people said, I told you folklore, kare bhai Pandav maa se gaye the. And that's when this tradition started. So, in fact, Dr. Y.S. Parmar, Yashwant Singh Parmar, who was chief minister of Himachal Pradesh in the 70s and a very tall leader of the Congress party there, his PhD apparently was on the subject of polyandry among the tribals of higher reaches of Himachal Pradesh. So, I don't believe that polyandry is generally an issue in almost any part of India. But maybe if you talk about polygamy, to cover for it, you say polyandry as well. So, ban polygamy and polyandry, again, ensure equal rights of inheritance for Muslim women from their parents. So it's not as if a Muslim woman, if the parents pass away, Muslim woman is dependent entirely on the husband's assets. She should also get a part of the inheritance, her share of the inheritance from the parents' assets. Now, for the BJP, how important this is? First of all, the politics. BJP has had three core demands. That is Article 370, which is now gone. The temple in Ayodhya, which is now coming up. And the third promise remains, that is the Uniform Civil Code. And that's what they are working on now. And that's what they are now building into one of their major plans for the 2024 elections. In Uttar Pradesh itself, the government is talking about this. Uttar Pradesh Deputy CM KP Maurya, he said some time back that they are considering seriously a Universal Civil Code. In Karnataka, again going for elections, Chief Minister Bommai has talked about it and he's also setting up a committee. So, all these committees are coming up and then the arguments go on. What is the argument? One argument is from the anti-BJP side. That includes political parties and social liberals who say that, look, there is no need to interfere with the personal laws of different faiths. The constitution guarantees people of different faiths to live according to their own traditions and the principle of their own laws. The counter argument is, it's the same country, as Shivraj Singh Chauhan said, ek desh do vidhan kyun chale, one country, different sets of laws, why should that be permissible? After all, if a Hindu, I think there seems to be a lot of heartburn about polygamy. If a Hindu can only have one wife, why can a Muslim have four wives? So that is one of the things, that there should be only one law. Again, there are those who oppose this idea who say, one, it will be politically disruptive and socially disruptive, but also that it will be constitutionally wrong and untenable. But at the same time, if you read the Constitution, Article 44, which is a directive principle of state policy, it does not make it incumbent upon the state to do this, but it's an advice, right? It's an advice like this. There's much else there, including that we should have prohibition, all of us should stop drinking, not just in Bihar and Gujarat, as is the case now, although we know in both those cases, peene wale ko peene ka bahana chahiye. Whoever wants to drink can get their stuff, but not legally. But if you follow DPSPs, that is directive principles, life could get very complicated if maybe perfect in some utopian situation. So give workers a role in the management of companies. State should endeavor to bring about global peace and security, etc., etc. A lot of these are wishes. These are wish lists under the directive principles. So, directive principles, Article 44 comes under Part 4 of the Constitution. So, Part 4 of the Constitution has these non-binding factors. Article 37 then states that these principles, DPSPs, are not enforceable. They are not enforceable. Article 31, however, says, and that's very important, and that's what the supporters of UCC say, that Article 31 of the Constitution says that if the state makes any law, Parliament, state means Parliament in this case, makes any laws in accordance with DPSPs, that means any laws that follow the directive principles, those laws will not be challenged as being violative of fundamental rights under Article 14 and 19. What that basically means broadly, not specifically, but broadly that means is, if Parliament enacts a law following the directives of the DPSPs, Directive Principles of State Policy, that will not be seen as violative of the basic structure of the Constitution. I'm saying it very broadly, not specifically, because these are issues that sometimes 13-judge benches have to debate and arrive at a conclusion. Now, in India, when it comes to personal laws, it's not just Hindu and Muslim and Christian and Sikhs and Catholics and Protestants and this and that. It's very complicated because there are regions and states of India where different kinds of laws prevail. Now, look at the tribal states of India. Look at the Northeast. Northeast has 200 tribes, right? 200 distinct tribes. And many of those tribes have their own cultural traditions which are followed. In Nagaland, for example, traditional customary laws are protected by the Constitution, and to mess with them will create a big problem there. Now, many parts of the Northeast, I don't exactly know what the situation is now, but until not very long ago, system of blood money was also prevalent. That means somebody killed somebody's family member, you could pay compensation, etc., etc., and settle it. Slowly, modern law has been creeping into these areas. But do it all by fiat is going to be very, very, very complicated. Again, there are parts of India where Portuguese family laws prevail. Goa, for example, the French family laws prevail. I presume Pondicherry and some others for that matter. So to put it all together in one homogenizer and press the button, it goes up and you see one fury, that's going to be very complicated. Now, how will this be done if this is done? Can the states do it? Now, states think they can do it. Can the states do it? Well, I mean, you can say the states can do it. Marriage, divorce, these things like that are on the concurrent list. So states can make their own laws. States can make their own laws, but again, we have something in the Constitution. The power to make laws for Parliament is provided by Article 245, read with Article 246, with the lists in 7th schedule. So anything said under the 4th schedule, which is Article 44, which recommends or demands or prescribes a uniform civil code, that doesn't give the state or parliament the power to make laws. That is 245 read with 246 in 7th schedule. Now, again, if you go on reading the Constitution, Article 254 tells you that a state government can make laws even in concurrent areas on subjects which are on concurrent list, but those laws cannot be contrary to central laws. So if the center does not have a uniform civil code, how could the state have one? But again, there is a twist there. You can have a state can have a law which is contrary to central laws, provided the president gives her assent to that law. And in this case, if a BJP-run state passes such a law and it's a BJP-run government running this center, chances are, or it's logical, that government, that cabinet will then recommend to the president to give assent to that law. But look at the practicality of the situation and how ridiculous it might seem if the center does not change the law itself, but at the same time recommends to the president to give assent to the change of the same law or enactment of the same fresh family law, uniform family law, for a state in the same union. Once again, if different states have different laws, you can say, all right, laissez-faire, jiski jo marzi hai karo, one state can have one law, as is the situation, say, in America. And we see the debate in America about divorce, for example. The different states can now, after the Supreme Court there struck down Roe versus Wade, different states can make their own abortion laws, right? So people are now looking at which state can I go to find abortion, right? Similarly, in India, if different states were to have different marriage laws, personal laws, people would get married in one state, then they start living somewhere else. If they have to have a divorce, do they seek a divorce under the laws of that state, or do they go back to their original state and seek divorce there? This will be a dog's breakfast. It's not going to happen. So this whole idea that different states could pass their own personal laws is going to create a mess. It will also create a big federal crisis. So that's not going to happen. Now, look, let's also cut out the chaff, right? Take out the chaff. Look at the grain. What is the issue? The issue, basically, the divisive issue, the polarizing issue, the issue that gets BJP's voters or prospective voters excited is the Muslim personal laws. And this idea that, look, Muslims have a good time, Muslim men can have many lives, Muslim men, whenever they feel like, can divorce their women. That's the reason BJP government amended the law to ban triple talaq. It's very easy. You say talaq, 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 and it's over. Huh? And Muslim women can get married much earlier, say at the age of 16. Whereas among non-Muslims, if anybody has sexual relationship with a woman under the age of 18, it's statutory rape, right? Under POCSO. So what kind of injustice is this? Only recently, two high courts have given judgments saying that a Muslim woman marrying at the age of 16, that is well below the legal of age of marriage, under the larger national law, which is 18 for women, that is legal and legitimate, right? So once again, there is this argument that how can Muslim women can get married at 16 and the others at 18. This is also posited as an argument of fairness, that look, if 18 is the minimum age, if 18 is the age of adulthood, below which even consensual sex amounts to rape, how can people of one faith be marrying at the age of 16? That is unfair to Muslim women, quote unquote. That is unfair to Muslim women. That is how it is being posited. And then questions arise that, you know, in many Muslim countries, laws have been reformed and changed already. So as I was reading up on this, I also remembered that in Pakistan, in fact, most of these laws have been reformed and changed, and not now. They were changed in 1961. And I will tell you a bit about that. 1961, Pakistan had a dictator, Field Marshal Ayub Khan. So he was the master and commander of everything. He could do what he wanted, but they were very strong ulema. So women in Pakistan and Pakistani civil society had been agitating for many years to get fairness in their own personal laws, in Islamic personal laws. And that movement started, and those protests started very soon after Pakistan was formed. So Pakistan government set up a commission to look into these personal laws. That commission gave its report in 1956. As that report came out, there were massive protests led by the ulema all over Pakistan. The prominent Maulvis leading this, Maulana Maududi, Muhammad Shafi, and as Ayub acquired more power, Ayub was known to be contemptuous of Muslim clergy, and he said that he was going to accept the recommendations of this commission and bring in a new law. And that law was called Muslim Family Law Ordinance of 1961. In fact, I'm sharing with you a paper written on that law by a scholar in Punjab University of Lahore, that is PUNJAB, My Punjab University, which came into being after partition, that is PANJAB. So that paper, please see that, that will be with the description. So Ayub Khan then said, look, I don't think that the commission's recommendations trespass any Islamic jurisprudence, if at all, and I'm quoting Ayub here, if at all, they provide profound judicial structure to employ Islamic family laws. And he said, I see it as my duty, being a Muslim and the head of an Islamic state, to make these changes. So this ordinance came into being on 15th of July 1961. Among the various things it said, I'm giving you the highlights. Number one, all marriages, all nikahs will have compulsory registration. And if you didn't do that, then it was punishable as a criminal offense with a 3-month jail sentence. Number two, polygamy. So it's not as if polygamy was banned automatically, but if a man wanted to have a second wife, there was a process. You have to make an application in writing to the arbitration council or the magistrate. There, you had to give your reasons for wanting a second wife, and you had to also give the permission, written permission, from your earlier wife or wives. Then the arbitration council were to hold hearings, and if they arrived at the conclusion that it was indispensable that you needed a second wife. Usually, I think it was if you didn't have a child, etc., I suppose. If the council or a magistrate came to the conclusion that it was indispensable for you to have another wife, only then, if you got permission in writing, you could marry a second time. And if you were in violation of this, if you did this without permission, without clearance, without due process, without legal clearances and without these hearings, once again, the outcome, the punishment was criminalized. It was a 1 year jail. It wasn't just a civil offense. Number three, talaq. There was no automatic triple talaq. That was taken away. So if you wanted to divorce, then you had to again apply to the council in writing. There would be no divorce for at least 90 days, even if you had told your wife. And the council would then call everybody, hold hearings, and then take a call. And then, very interestingly, Section 9 of this ordinance also said that a woman who is divorced, if she thinks that she's not being fully provided for by her husband, could go to an authority, an already appointed authority, seeking maintenance. Now, remember the kind of commotion we had in our country and how our politics was turned upside down over the Shah Bano case, because she only went to court asking for a couple of hundred rupees per month of compensation. And the clergy then made a big issue of it, saying that a Muslim woman cannot ask for maintenance. So in Pakistan, this had been allowed in 1961. And it also fixed the minimum age of marriage, which in 1961 was fixed at 16. So once again, the age of marriage was fixed according to this law. So if you look at all this, you can see that an Islamic country did it. But probably it's easier for a country of one faith, or a country that essentially makes laws for one faith, to reform their laws. In a country like ours, where there is a large majority and there are many minorities, there are many insecurities. So any effort to bring about any kind of homogenization in personal laws then becomes a divisive political issue. And you know what? That's precisely the reason why BJP has started this campaign now, just 18 months from the next general elections.